The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And. Before we get started, this podcast marks the 100th episode of Getting to Yes And. So I want to thank Todd Manley, L.F. Jarrus, and all the folks at WGN who have helped us create the show, as well as Steve Johnston, Andrew Alexander, Darcy Stewart, Marilyn Cox, and the whole team at Second City and Second City Works for having our back. When I knew that the 100th episode was coming up, I asked my kids if they had an idea of who I should have on the 100th show. Yes, they both said, Mom.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Anne Libra. Anne is Director of Comedy Studies and the Comedy Writing and Performance BA at Columbia College Chicago, which is a collaboration with the Second City, and it's the first degree of its kind in the United States. She served as the Executive Artistic Director of the Second City Training Centers from 2001 to 2009. As a stage director, her credits include Stephen Colbert's one-man show, Describing a Circle, The Madness of Curious George, Computer Chips and Salsa, and The Second City Goes to War, as well as Second City touring productions all over the world. Her book, The Second City Almanac of Improvisation, is published by Northwestern University Press. She's the director of improv pedagogy for the Second Science Project, which marries the study of improvisation and behavioral science, a partnership between Second City and the Center for Decision Research at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. The long list of her former students who have gone on to success in improvisation and comedy include, just to name a few, Ashley Nicole Black, A.D. Bryant, Jenny Hagel, Jordan Peele, Amy Poehler, Kristen Schaal, and Steven Yeun. Anne has presented on topics of improvisation and comedy at the Aspen Ideas Festival, Chicago Ideas Week, and she's guest lectured at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And she's my wife, Anne Libra. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Let's get into it.
Okay.
In 2004, in the Second City Almanac of Improvisation, you wrote, quote, "In an art form based on agreements, probably the only thing we all agree on is that there are as many approaches to improvisation as there are practitioners." It's 2018. Do you still believe that?
Oh, 100%.
So
go ahead.
No. What has it changed? Is it more? What is the
Well, it's always thing? It's always different. I think that the wonderful thing about improvisation and improvisation training is that it's teaching people to think on their feet, to work with other people, to be more than they are in the moment, to make discoveries, to be creative, all this stuff that we are building into all these other businesses, right? Where we're mm-hmm. working with caring across generations, where we're working with the University of Chicago. And the fact of the matter is that means that different people respond to different things, that they're going to make different discoveries. Having said all of that, I think that there is a core principle, and the core principle of improvisation is finding the way to put your focus so that you turn down what our friends at the University of Chicago would call the system two, the judging part of your brain. Hmm. You turn that down and it allows the intuitive, quick part of your brain to really play and make discoveries.
Would that also be called the fear brain, fear part of your brain?
You're turning down the fear part of your brain, which is the judging part of your brain,
yeah.
and turning up the sometimes stupid but brave part of your brain.
Yeah, well, that's where the comedy comes in.
Yes.
So what I'm hearing from you is that It makes sense that there's different schools of improvisation because they might speak to the way that human beings are wired differently.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that there aren't some core underpinnings, chief among which is this idea of getting out of your own way.
Yeah. Well, I think, so this is an interesting thing, is that there are a million ways to teach improvisation, and there are a million different ways in which people have responses to improvisation. Mm-hmm. But at the real core of the work, and whether you say yes and I know this is called getting to yes and.
Do not blow this for me.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to.
Okay.
I actually prefer the term explore and heighten functionally.
Mm-hmm.
Because it fills out a lot of things more. If you're exploring something, you're looking at all the different avenues that you can go with. And then if you're heightening, you're moving forward. And so it takes it away from a simple yes, and moves it into there's all sorts of ways to say yes. So all sorts of ways to explore and heighten something.
Well, we know this to be true in the sense that the best improvisers in the world rarely, if ever, say the words yes, and.
Right.
But when you're first starting out, it's simply to address the fact that it is likely that your default is either to do nothing or to say no.
Sure, because it's a way of keeping the scary things away. No is a very powerful word that gives you control. And when you're first improvising, it's terrifying because it's all about not being in control. And I think that at the very essence of improvisation, this is true of all improvisation systems, they find ways to make you feel safe so that you can be out of control in ways that you're not used to being out of control.
Hmm. That's interesting. All right. So you've been at this for 30 years.
Yeah.
What are some essential misunderstandings of improvisation?
Well, one simple is that improvisation is always funny. I mean, mm-hmm. I teach comedy, and that is I run I'm every parent's worst nightmare, right? I run a comedy major.
Mm-hmm.
But improvisation and comedy are actually two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
And what people create improvisationally can be funny, but it can also be very sad, or it can be collaborative in all sorts of other ways that have nothing to do with comedy per se.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big one. And
yep.
I think there's what's interesting about improvisation, I'm just going to go off on a little tangent here. To me, what's interesting about improvisation is that the way it creates comedy is really different from the other ways of creating comedy, from writing jokes
mm-hmm.
or even from slapstick, that when people laugh at improvisation, what they're laughing at is recognizable human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And what improvisation does really brilliantly when you do it right is that it creates recognizable behavior, and we laugh because we're like, oh my God, that's that thing that I didn't even know other people had observed about the way that people behave.
All right. So let's talk about comedy and comedy school.
Yes.
Can you teach people to be funny?
So I have been asked that question a million times.
That's why I asked it.
I know. And the fact of the matter is no, you can't. There are people who are not funny.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is, but who cares? There are also people who I can't hit a ball with a bat.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean you still can't teach people baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So what I always say is, I can't teach you to be funny, but if you're funny, I can make you funnier.
Mm-hmm.
And so to even suggest that comedy is somehow this either you have it or you don't thing is ridiculous. People get better at comedy through practice.
Like anything, like sports and instruments
anything.
Or whatever. Yes.
Yeah. And what's really fascinating about comedy to me is I think that because it's so human, because it is to laugh is so universal. It's the thing we do before we speak. That there is this interesting idea that somehow comedy is innate, and therefore not worthy of study, not worthy of deeper philosophy, not worthy of academics, because it is, well, and here's the other thing, it's not just that it's innate, the idea of, like, it belongs to anybody, so why would
mm-hmm.
we study it?
Mm-hmm.
But also this idea that it is connected to the parts of us that we don't want to expose, that it's connected to fear, that it's connected to taboo.
Vulnerability.
That's connected to absolutely vulnerability. The idea that there's a Mike Nichols quote that I have been looking for to specifically quote for a long time. And if anybody has it, please let me know. But he talks about the idea that tragedy is a guy buys a gun and then shoots his lover. Mm-hmm. And that in that tragedy, there's no in-betweens. Comedy is about the guy taking the bus to the gun store and not having the right change to get on the bus and then having to go back home and then come back. And then he gets to the gun store, he buys the gun, but he forgets to buy bullets, so he has to go back again. And it's all this sort of gross, quotidian stuff, the stuff that, like, when we want to tell the story of our lives, we want to tell all the high points. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the everyday points that are about washing the dishes or about all the things that we want to kind of hide in ourselves. And so in some ways, I think people don't feel like comedy is valuable because it's the parts of themselves that they kind of want to hide. So, yeah, vulnerable.
I've said it before on here, which is like no one wants to hear your good story where everything works out. That's not interesting.
No.
The only interesting stories are fiascos.
Yeah, the really funny ones are the worst fiascos. When I tell students, ask students to start to generate ideas for comic sketches or ideas for stand-up, the best stories are the worst thing that could happen to you at this point in your life, or what was the worst thing that happened to you when you were 13, or what did you think was the worst thing that could happen to you when you were 21? That the worst day of my life can be the funniest day of my life because it is the story of failure and vulnerability. And, you know, and I've got my comedy triangle, which is connected to a lot of different kinds of comedy theory, but is sort of my own variation on that, which is that comedy has three legs to it. It has to be true. You have to recognize it. You have to see it as something that you know about. And you recognize it. And good comedy is recognized deeply, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's really true. The when we laugh at our favorite stand-ups, it's because they say things that we know are really true. But it can also be really true as in that word means two different things and I know both meanings. Mm-hmm. It has to have some level of pain. And that pain might be slapstick, but it might be cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. It might be embarrassment. It might be taboo. Something in it has to be painful. And then the third thing it has to have is it has to have a level of context that allows it not to be. Because if it's just truth and pain, it's horrible.
Tragedy. Yeah.
It's the reality of our everyday existence if you're depressed.
Right.
But you create this context, this distance. And I like to use distance because I think it functions both in terms of time and space.
Right.
It can be temporal. People talk about, comedy is tragedy plus time. Mm-hmm. Or my favorite Mel Brooks quote, which is, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die. Mm-hmm. But this level of distance, and you have to have all three. So the distance gives you the perspective to see it with a level of objectivity that allows you to sort of, you know, laugh in the face of pain and truth.
So there's all these different theories around comedy. Mm-hmm. And we had Peter McGraw on the podcast who has his particular one. You play with that, right? You think there's more to it than benign violation theory, which is Peter's
thing. So from my perspective, And by the way, I think I need to say I am working on this sort of three-part theory is a theory of comedy. It's a theory for people who want to construct comedy. Mm-hmm. And what Peter's really working on is a theory of humor, mm-hmm. which is more connected to why do people laugh.
Okay.
And as a result, his theory actually does hold up for, like, why do we laugh when we're tickled?
Yeah.
Right? Because mm-hmm. it's a violation, but it's benign.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he's missing what for me, if you're creating comedy, is a key point, which is the recognition.
Yeah.
The idea that I have to see this, I have to understand it, I have to recognize it as true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the piece that in terms of benign violation, he's just not even dealing with.
Right.
But it's not funny to me if I don't understand it. If you can describe a behavior that is both benign and a violation, but if it confuses me, mm-hmm. why would someone behave like that?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's not funny to me.
Right. And we can go deeper on this.
Yes. If you,
like, we might as well, because we've got the comedy nerd on the podcast.
This is what I do.
So where else does this theory go? What other elements exist inside, like, what kind of comedy exists out there?
So one of the other things that I'm really interested in, and there's a lot of the theory of comedy that's out there, a lot of the books that are about comedy that are out there are primarily about jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't come from, I come from Second City, where we do tell jokes, but jokes are
on
not
occasion.
The key
mm-hmm.
part of what we do.
Nope.
We have this whole other thing, and you can watch, and I always go back to Nichols and May. You can watch, they do this wonderful piece called Teenagers, about two teenagers in a car deciding whether or not they're going to have sex. And there's almost no jokes in it. It's all behavior. And so as a comedy teacher, as a comedy theorist, as a comedy scholar, I became very interested in this idea that comedy, that you can't say everything's a joke or a gag. So what we teach within my program is this idea that there are really five components to comedy, and jokes is one.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's some crossover between all of them. So you,
sure.
like any of these taxonomies, you're going to have a crossover. But the second one is physical comedy, and physical comedy isn't just slipping a banana peel, but it's really comedy of the senses.
Mm-hmm.
It's comedy of our awareness of how our bodies move in space, so proprioception. It's comedy. You can literally have, and you think of somebody like Grant Achatz, the chef, you can have taste comedy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
Where you have something that you're expecting to taste one way. You know, they tell you, eat it this way, slowly, you know, put it the whole thing in your mouth and then let it burst, because it's got that kind of surprise element to
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
Or it's got dissonance to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's jokes, there's physical comedy, there's narrative, comic story.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me goes back to that Mike Nichols thing of a comic story is at the ground floor and a tragic story is looking at the world from, 30,000 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something interesting in comic stories, which is the fourth component of comedy, which is character.
Mm-hmm.
That a comic story is about a character who always has hope and who never gives up trying to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine, and I had this conversation with my students in my freshman comedy survey class, if you imagine an I Love Lucy episode without Lucy's hope and willingness to, some of them would be really creepy and sad.
Yeah, and depressing.
Yeah.
And terrible.
There's the episode where she gets a sunburn so that Ricky won't hit her.
That's problematic.
It's terrifying. But it's not terrifying because she's a comic character and it doesn't – she has hope.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't see the problem. She sees the problem as solvable and not as terrifying.
Right.
So character is a huge thing, and character is really interesting to me. Jokes don't travel well. They don't travel well across countries, from country to country. They don't travel well across time. And that goes back to this idea of recognition. Jokes depend on a certain level of reference. You know, so something can be very funny to us because we know all the players, but not funny to someone else. Character is fascinating because it seems to be, if not universal, close to universal. There are these comic characters who show up throughout time, from the Greeks and Romans to Commedia to Shakespeare to, and Molière to modern-day sitcom, and they're essentially the same guys. Homer Simpson shows up in Greek Greek theater and Greek storytelling pre-birth of Christ. And similarly, there are trickster characters who are across continents. Every culture seems to have some word for the guy who plays a trick on you to get his way. And usually a low status guy. So character jokes are very jokes don't travel well, but character seems to travel really well. And then the final thing is point of view. And point of view is actually, from my own perspective, it's two things. It is it's the thing when we watch a stand-up or we watch a show and we feel like the person, the stand-up or the show understands us and is talking to us. So we don't always, when we watch drama or tragedies, we often get sucked into the story, right? We identify with characters. In comedy, most of the time we feel like we're aware of the person who's telling us the story. And part of what we love is knowing the person who's going to tell us the story and sort of anticipating how they're going to tell us the story or why. Or, you know, so people say now, you know, I can't wait to hear what Colbert has to say about this.
Right.
Because they are fascinated by his point of view. But point of view is also ultimately what does the comedian or what is the creator of the comedy, the authorial point of view, what do I have to say about this thing? How am I showing you I am – and we, I and Libra am looking at something and I'm saying, oh, have you looked at it like this?
I just, I'm thinking back to the hardest I've ever laughed at the telling of a story. And you might remember, you weren't there, but I told you about it. It was when we did like a Hurricane Katrina benefit in Las Vegas. We all went to dinner afterwards with a bunch of alumni. And Jeff Garlin and Richard Kind kept egging Tim Kazurinsky to tell his worst date ever story, which went on for like 15 minutes. And Keegan-Michael Key was there. I mean, the people I've just named are the loudest Second City alumni in the world, howling. We're crying. We're laughing. Sorry. And for anyone who doesn't know, Tim Kazurinsky, that man knows how to tell a joke and he knows how to tell a story. And he's old school. So it is like, I don't know, you feel like you were in the, you know, your show shows writer's room because he's that level. And I'll never forget it. It was just a, and then earlier when we were talking about fiascos and storytelling, that This American Life episode about fiascos with the Peter Pan. If like Google Peter Pan, This American Life, it is a youth theater show gone awry, and it just it's so terrible, it's so tragic, and so funny.
So funny
again because of the distance. So jokes, physical, narrative, character, POV. All right, so people can conflate if they know it or or if they sort of this you've got comedy studies and you've got the comedy major at Columbia. Maybe just sort of table set the difference and you know and how it sort of came to be maybe
okay,
that
Okay, yes.
That
well, no, so comedy studies is was the beginning thing. Comedy studies came out of a couple of different places, not the least of which is that Andrew Alexander said, why don't we have a – I was the artistic director of the training center at that time and also teaching at Columbia as an adjunct. And Andrew said, why don't we have a college program at the training center? And I said, because we don't want to teach science and math. We don't have the expertise to teach science and math. But out of that conversation, it started. It connected to some other conversations I was having with you, mm-hmm. with Mary Scruggs, who was the head of the writing program, and my dear friend, and we, and Sheldon Batinkin, who was one of the founders of Second City and was the chair at Columbia at the time, about wanting to go deeper. Mm-hmm. About wanting to provide that what we were discovering is that the people who were really succeeding were people who were not just writers, but writers and improvisers and actors. So mm-hmm. what the idea was basically to create a semester abroad at Second City, mm-hmm. and that the college credit would be provided by Columbia. Mm-hmm. So that's Comedy Studies. It still exists as a semester abroad.
And that started like how many years ago?
2000. It's 10 years. So 2007. Spring of 2007.
Anyone you remember from the first class?
Allison Bosma, who is in the very first class, is now a television writer in L.A. who's writing on the Year of Living Biblically show.
Hmm.
And Megan Mercier co-wrote... film with Swanberg's wife.
Joe Swanberg.
Joe Swanberg's wife.
Okay.
There's people from that very first. Adie Bryant, I think, was in like the second or third.
From Saturday Night Live.
From Saturday Night Live was in the mm-hmm. second or third class. Mm-hmm. And then Justin and Jordan Shipley, I'm going to say. Justin was in maybe the third or fourth class, and they co-created Wrecked, which is a sitcom on TBS. So mm-hmm. we've got people, and this is my theory is that there's a Comedy Studies mafia that is slowly taking over. Mm-hmm. We've got people writing on shows, we've got people performing. There's an enormous number of stand-ups. Who all sort of had this Chelsea Devantes, who was a Second City main stage performer and is now writing for Jordan Klepper's show, The Opposition. Mm-hmm. There's a really sort of broad range of people who did Comedy Studies, but it's open to juniors in college.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be
juniors or seniors.
You have to have 60 credit hours and above.
Mm-hmm.
And they come and take a full semester of classes at Second City, writing, acting, improvisation, physical and vocal prep for comedy, history of comedy, which is the class that I teach, so I get to be all nerdy about that, and a class called The Professional Comedian, where they talk about careers in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really intense, amazing thing. And again, open to students from wherever. And in fact, a lot of the people who take the Comedy Studies program, they really want to be comedians, but they're at Ivy League schools getting their actual degree in international studies.
Right.
Or they're, you know, we get a really interesting range of like hippy dippy California schools. The one girl from the Southern Baptist College who this is what she wants to do. People from East Coast liberal arts schools. It's a really fairly broad range, as well as students from Columbia College.
And then how'd that lead to the major?
Well, pretty quick. Mm-hmm. What led to the major was we had a bunch of students who said, we want more.
Mm-hmm.
And the recognition that we were just touching on the skill set that it requires to be a comedian. I think the thing that makes us really unique is most college programs are medium based.
Right.
You study theater, you study TV, you study advertising. You're really looking at your medium. And the fact of the matter is that our world now, and certainly comedy in particular, the success comes from people who are writer, director, performers who work across medium,
mm-hmm.
who turn, you know, Issa Rae, who did Confessions of Awkward Black Girl as a web series that then turned into an HBO series.
Mm-hmm.
People hire you as a writer for a sitcom off of the stand-up that you do. So the ability, and you think of the people like Tina Fey, the Stephen Colberts, the Jordan Peele,
mm-hmm.
you know, to go from improviser to sketch performer to writer to director, and he's still bringing that same those same elements of skill set together. So the thinking about it as a cross medium was a really big piece of it. And if you start thinking about that, the recognition is that while the semester is amazing, what you can do over 4 years of college is that much deeper and that much more.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that we learn as we age inside our industries and, mm-hmm. and we mature as individuals and we realize, wow, almost everything boils down to communication. Like something communicated poorly right. is the problem. Something communicated well is a thing of beauty. And because comedy is so sticky as a communication device, right. advertisers use it relentlessly. Mm-hmm. You know, Twitter is such a comedy-based platform. But if you haven't practiced or studied comedy, my God, you like, what are you doing? And so, you know, I think when people think about going to comedy school, they're like, well, everyone's going to be a comedian. It's like, no. What they're learning is to hone their comic voice for a level of communication, which can be applied across a variety of industries and professions.
Well, and you know, one of the other things that, and we've talked about this connection between comedy and improvisation and design thinking, is that the other thing that you get to do when you really study comedy is you get to study, because the way comedians work is that they see a thing they want to do, they bring it to they have an idea, they bring it to a level of completion, mm-hmm. they try it out in front of an audience, and then they go back and revise. And the ability to do that is, again, a skill that you really kind of desperately need, particularly in this day and age where we're working fast. We're working mm-hmm. in a variety of mediums that we don't quite understand yet.
Yeah, and that the context changes by the minute.
Yes. Well, an understanding of context and understanding of how to – I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why touring with the Second City is such a incredibly valuable tool, is discovering how comedy changes from context to context to context means that you have a kind of a good idea, not a foolproof idea, but you often have a much better idea of how to shape your message for different audiences across places.
Yeah, so you and I got a lot of calls when the whole controversy arose around comics not wanting to play at colleges. Mm-hmm. And I think that the difference, actually, when I thought about it more, is I get how an individual comic could be frustrated and confused and then come up with this thing of, like, they're just PC and I don't want to play. The difference that we've got is we're not touring at the colleges, you and I,
right.
But we've overseen various companies that have been for 3 decades, if not more.
Yeah.
And so we have an arc that we can understand. And then the young comic who's doing it, this is new for them, and they're going to be out of it, hopefully, because they get hired on the resident mm-hmm. stage and they're done doing colleges. So when that whole controversy erupted, I think people expected us to take this stand of, like, oh, yeah, those snowflakes can't take anything. And that wasn't our stand.
No. Well, because we were interested in one of the biggest things about Second City, and one of the things that makes me really interested in Second City as a director mm-hmm. and as an artist, is the idea that Second City is in conversation with its audience, and that what makes it exciting is, and this is true with all of comedy, right? I can't yell at you for not laughing at my joke. I have to figure out why you didn't laugh at my joke,
right?
And I will say this, and because I teach history of comedy, you look back at George Carlin and some of those guys in the late 60s, early 70s, and they saw college campuses as a place where they could do anything, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Vegas clubs where they might have been censored a little bit.
Right.
So the part of it is there's this idea that you can just go to a college campus and basically squat on the stage and do your business and they'll love you. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly discovering that college students have a point of view and they're not just going to applaud your every move.
I just want to note that if anyone heard my phone go off, it's our daughter trying to call me.
Okay.
I didn't pick up.
Really?
No, I didn't.
And I guarantee that there is a text on my phone.
Yeah. All right. We're going to keep going. I'm not even stopping the podcast for this.
We know that it's about, like, could she buy something?
Exactly. Oh, the fodder of our children for our comedy careers. We're coming close to the end. You know, one thing I do want to talk to you about, because I interviewed our friend Ai-jen Poo for the podcast, and many of you folks were probably seeing the Golden Globes. And, you know, we found out a day or so before when she sent a note out that Meryl Streep invited Ai-jen to be her date at the Golden Globes as an activist representing the National Domestic Workers Alliance. The other organization that she works for is called Caring Across Generations. And you've been developing the curriculum for that program.
Yeah, so we're developing a six-week improvisation curriculum for caregivers that's going to be rolled out at
Cleveland Clinic.
Wow, I just lost it. Yeah, at the Cleveland Clinic in Las Vegas, and this is going to be Second City has done some of this work in the past with in-home caregivers. This is specifically a curriculum for family caregivers, but it's taking those communication skills, but also the skills of sort of being aware of agency and what you have power over and what you don't. It's the skills of thinking of yourself as part of a team as opposed to taking it all on yourself. And what does it feel like not just to be supported, but also to support people supporting you?
Yeah.
To listen. And then very fundamentally, and I know you've interviewed some of the folks who've used improvisation for Alzheimer's and dementia, is the ability of working with people in those situations where you give them agency, that you're willing to live in their world and hear them in the way that they want to be heard. And all of these improvisational exercises, they give you practice in it, and they also help you to assess how those things make you feel. I think a lot of us are not always aware of our own preferences and behavior.
Yeah.
You know, what we cop to, what we end up doing. I've often had students in my adult classes where they do something and they're like, I'm bad at that. Or I never do that. And then they do it and they're like, oh, I do that.
Right.
So it allows you to practice and alter or make alterations to the way you behave in situations that might be more stressful or might be harder.
I think this is probably the most exciting thing about the work we're involved in right now, is this ability to mash up what we know and the expertise that others bring to us. And certainly in my time producing at Second City, that was something I pursued in our projects that we did with like Lyric Opera or Hubbard Street Dance or regional theaters across the country. But I don't think I ever realized that we could do it with, you know, the teaching as well, and that's become huge.
Well, and it is, there's a sort of no duh.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and certainly when we talk to people who are interested in interactive of anything, improvisation, and certainly to improvisation itself, has grown mightily in the last 30 years, you know, to think of how many people are teaching and participating in improvisation across the country, across the world, than were when we first started out. It's really stunning.
Yeah.
But what it means, though, is there's an awareness that, oh, this stuff can do a thing. And I used to, you know, years ago when I was the artistic director of the training centers, I used to say to people, this work is going to change your life. And it does. And it may not change it in the way that you're expecting it to. I mean, a lot of people come into improvisation thinking they're going to be on Saturday Night Live. Instead, what it does is you would literally see people go through a metamorphosis because of their awareness of awareness of their behavior and their awareness of their own ability to change their behavior. And that, in those relationships that we're having now with people like Caring Across Generations, where we're able to use their expertise to help people make those changes in other spheres, it's really some of the most meaningful work that I get to do.
Okay, so the way we end the podcast is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So an improvisation, as we've sort of referred to earlier, the idea is that if you're making something out of nothing, you can't say no, and you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Well, I actually have two. And one I actually already sort of alluded to, which is Andrew saying to me, why can't we have a college program?
Right.
And I really did come back and say, yes, we can do that. And it's going to be this semester abroad. And then the second and, which was the and of the comedy major, that I didn't even foresee when I said yes and to the first proposition.
Right. And look what happened.
Yeah. So the second one is very romantic.
Okay. I hope it's about me.
It's about you.
Okay.
No, it is that I'm going to cry.
Okay.
It is at Stephen Colbert's rehearsal dinner, which was actually a fairly big party.
Yes.
Larger than either of our mutual wedding.
Yes.
You said to me on the dance floor, will you marry me? And it was really kind of out of the blue. We'd known each other for a very long time. We'd worked together. We'd only been together for a couple months. And I said yes. And then later that night, we were on the beach and sort of looked at each other and said, do we really mean this?
Right.
And that to me, actually, is the second one. I mean, I said yes, absolutely, at the beginning, but the yes and was that second time.
Yeah.
Right? Of like, yes,
well,
absolutely.
we checked in because we were like, are we really going to commit to this? Because we both were married before and it didn't work out.
Well, and also it was so new, except that the thing I knew about you is that we'd already been working. We'd already had the huge fights.
Right.
We'd already had the, like, you know, I knew that if I was in love with you in that way right then, that with all the history we already had, that it was for good.
Ann Liber, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine going down.